You're listening to Bottom Shelf Bitcoin. This is episode 68.
Good morning, everyone. Take a chill pill.
What is it?
Okay.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, the podcast that puts Bitcoin knowledge within everyone's reach. As always, I'm your host, Josh Humphrey, and you have probably been wondering where I've been for like a year. The short version is that, as many of you know, I am a nurse, and so work just got really stressful, and obviously Bitcoin doesn't need me, and I kind of checked out of anything non-work related for a bit. So anyways, I am glad to be back and talking to you guys and with you guys today with me back on the show. Had him on previously, I think episode 65 or something like that. You can go back and look. Adam Moore, aka Hodlberry. And we're going to be talking today. Adam, you wrote an article in response to another article. I'm gonna see if I can kind of very briefly summarize and then we'll go into it, but essentially there was an article that came out in the Gospel Coalition, which is a Christian website that did not present a very good light on Bitcoin or even an honest take of Bitcoin, and you kind of wrote an article in response to that in Bitcoin Magazine.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on. When I read the Gospel Coalition's article, like I saw red. I was like smoking out of my ears. It was really bad. I was very upset. Gospel Coalition, for people aren't that familiar with it, it's a very broadly evangelical and what we would consider reformed theology in Protestant circles. It has a large audience as far as evangelicals are concerned, more conservative. It tends to pull from a lot of the famous theologians or pastors from evangelicalism, and they write lots of articles on many different topics related to world events, kind of how things that are going on in the world. But not just that; it's mainly a lot of it is theological in nature, and they have a very large conference that happens every year. They tend to bring things kind of from like a middle of the road type of perspective. And it's kind of like your stereotypical, you know, kind of Dave Ramsey type of response. You know, he's a Christian as well, and kind of like do the normie thing. Don't get your investment advice from crazy Bitcoin or crypto people. Just kind of go with what is the tried and true method, quote unquote, of, you know, investing in stocks and bonds and mutual funds and things like that. So the article specifically was written by an economist who is a professor at Yale University. Apparently this guy is a Christian. And he wrote, you know, what he thought about Bitcoin, and it was just so bad. After I read the article, like I just started writing, I immediately was like, I got to write a response to this. This is incredible.
Yeah. The article just seemed so, bland and like you said, normie. And it felt like reading it was like, I don't understand your understanding of Bitcoin and maybe even economics is so mainstream. And I don't, it felt to me like it was kind of like, why did you even write this article? If that's the stance you're going to take of just like do the same thing that every other economist has been, you know, that you could find in any other.
Even CNBC and other places like that, like they have a much higher level of understanding of what Bitcoin is.
Yeah, exactly. This was just like, why did I felt like it was one of those articles that was like, if this was the stance you were going to take, this article didn't need to be written.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. I don't know if they had a lot of people asking questions about this and that's why they felt the need to write it. But, you know, it was clear from the point of view of the author that it was very Keynesian in its presentation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It talked a lot about, like, one of the things that really irked me about it was like this idea of the common good. And that's almost like a, in my opinion, that's more of a leftist kind of socialist, view of economics. And when you talk about, like, we need to be doing you need to be doing things as an individual for the common good. Like, don't forget, like, don't worry about the profit motive or worry about accumulating capital. It's, you know, you should be doing stuff with your private capital for the common good. So, like, almost a straddle kind of hybrid position between capitalism and socialism. And so it was really weird. And in the article, he actually does quote Keynes. And for that, I tried to rip him a new one. So this article, my article got picked up by Bitcoin Magazine. So I had some friends who do a website, like a Christian related website. And I was going to have them do it if Bitcoin Magazine didn't pick it up, and they did. So I was more than happy to let them run it. And I think overall it was pretty well received. It's funny. I was at a Presbyterian meeting, cause I'm a ruling elder in the PCA, and a pastor came up and be like, "Hey, did you write an article in Bitcoin Magazine?" one of his congregants had tried to orange pill him and use my article as like one of the things. It was kind of funny. People that I that were like in just my regular life were had kind of found me out a little bit.
Yeah, I was gonna ask, like, what's your approach to Bitcoin within the church, like in real life, like within your local church? I mean, is that something you're talking to people about on a regular basis or not? Or
yeah, I mean, everybody in my church, like, they'll text me every time the price goes up or down. I've pretty much talked to most people in my church about Bitcoin, and they know that I'm into it. Like, I'll post stuff on my personal Facebook or whatever. But yeah, I mean, I've had conversations with nearly everybody in my church, and most of them have actually bought Bitcoin, including all the ruling elders in my church, I think all the deacons in my church, and several other people. So they're on board, and they're generally liberty minded type of people. There are talks in the church of having us accept Bitcoin and actually hold Bitcoin. That's one of those things where that's something I really need to do, and I really need to get done for the church to give them a protocol to be able to hold the keys and, you know, who has access into his custody? How do we slice up the keys? Is there a third party custodian that has a key, and all those types of things? And then what type of policy are we going to have as far as, you know, when to sell? Like, how long do we hold on to it for? Do we just accept Bitcoin and keep the money in Bitcoin that we accept, and that's kind of like the last thing to be used? Do we convert cash donations into Bitcoin? Like, what's that going to look like? Probably what I'm assuming is going to happen is we're going to, almost like when a church or a private organization receives stock or bonds or other types of assets like that, they typically just hold on to those. And if they have cash, they just burn through the cash. And then if they need the other stuff, like part of their endowment or whatever, they go to that last. That would be how I would envision us doing that, because most people are just going to pay in cash, you know, donate in cash. I have been saving a portion of what I normally give to the church in Bitcoin in a separate account to eventually just kind of plunk down. That's actually an interesting thing. I'm not sure, like, should I do that before the end of the year or wait? Now we've taken a little dip. Maybe I might want to wait. But so overall, I think my church is generally Bitcoin friendly, but we haven't been like the Bitcoin church yet. At least I don't think that's where we want to focus. I don't think that's like when you kind of do something like that, when you take a stance and then you become known as that, And that's really not
right.
That's really not like the mission and focus of the church. And so I think it would be kind of a distraction, to be perfectly honest. Sure. On the other hand, if it was known that we did accept Bitcoin, maybe we'd get more donations from people around the world who were just interested in doing that. You never know. But overall, my church is friendly to Bitcoin, and that's been a good experience for me so far.
That's cool. Yeah, I've thought through that as well myself, and is similar of like, because I've had some people that are open to it, some people that, you know, that I had talked to about it, I don't know, a couple years ago, and then I kind of not gave up, but it was just like, okay, like they're clearly not interested right now. They know that they can come to me, and I've had people come back and say, hey, you know, I bought some or whatever, and that's cool. And if they want to talk more, we talk more. And I've thought about, okay, how do we open up to like be able to accept, you know, tithes and offerings in Bitcoin? But I don't want to try and push that until I have like a good plan of, like you say, of like how to receive and like what does the custody model look like? And especially for, you know, if you don't have people that are highly technical, there is a steep learning curve to Bitcoin. And like, where is that middle of the road of going, how much do you have to explain to people, and have the plan in place to safeguard without them having to understand everything and having to go down, you know, like a 3 month, you know, do they really have to be like fully orange pilled to accept it and all that? And like, I'm not looking to force that on anybody.
Yeah. I think it's going to be kind of weird because like, if they say like, oh yeah, sure, I'll accept Bitcoin, you know, and then it's kind of like, I'm accepting it just as a mode of getting dollars. You know, that's kind of not really like what I'm interested in for them. Like I would rather hold it myself. And then if once they needed money, like sell it for them. But if it's just like, yeah, I'll accept, you know, PayPal, Venmo, Cash App or whatever, and everything's going to get lumped in together into just dollar denominated wealth. That's not really why I'd want. And I would feel, not offended is not the right word, but I would feel annoyed, or I would feel like, slighted is not the right word, but I would feel like it was futile or pointless for me to have gone through and done that just for them to go ahead and because what my plan is, like the money that I'm going to be giving in Bitcoin, I'm expecting to be worth tenfold, hundredfold in the coming decades. And so it's like, don't act foolishly with the money that I think is going to be super, super valuable. I think that the most important thing you can do really is orange pilling people so that they themselves understand Bitcoin and they understand how things should be. And once they do, then the technical aspect of it is probably more trivial, because like the way I'm doing it now, where I'm custodying it kind of for them on their behalf almost, that's not ideal. And obviously not everybody can do that. And you don't want to just kind of like, I myself, I'm kind of trusting myself to keep the Bitcoin for them and then hand it over eventually. But it's almost like when Michael Saylor got orange pilled. Once that happened, and once other people on his board got orange pilled, it was like, we all got to just get as much as possible. It's not the same as somebody just understanding a little bit about it, thinking, oh, that's cool, that's neat, and then moving on with their life. There's, in order for it to be a major part of a nonprofit or a church, you have to, there's got to be fundamental understanding from the key stakeholders, and especially the people at the top.
Yeah, I think when I first went down the rabbit hole, then I tried to explain the how of Bitcoin to a lot of people who didn't care. And I think it's far more important to get the why Bitcoin to people first.
Yeah.
Because they're not really going to care about the how Bitcoin if they don't see a need or a benefit in Bitcoin for them personally or whatever. You know, kind of going back to the article, I think the original article that you wrote yours in response to did the same tired lines we see over and over again about like, oh, Bitcoin is for black market transactions and illicit things. And I think something that frustrates me about that is, especially when I see it come from the church, is this, I don't know, I guess to me, I'm like, well, don't you see all the bad, illegal things? Well, first of all, I think we need to be able to separate like things that are legal versus things that are moral.
Right.
Because, you know, I think a lot of Christians would applaud someone who lives in a country closed to the gospel, where it's illegal to be a Christian or illegal to talk about being a Christian, to smuggle Bibles in. They'd be fine with that. Right. But so using language like, oh, this is illegal, is not a very good framework for us to, as the church, to be, you know, government laws is not necessarily the best framework to be doing it on.
Well, you know, it's funny that you should mention that, because I'm starting to think more and more that Christians would be okay with that. You know, the further I kind of go in my Christian career and the more I understand the principles of liberty, I've started to realize that there really is there's a dichotomy, even in Christian circles, between obeying the law, or obeying the civil authorities, and obeying God. You know, it seems as if many Christians kind of feel like, well, if there's something that's not directly related to the gospel, like, you know, if they told me I can't preach the gospel anymore, like, obviously I'm not going to, because we have precedent for that, you know, Peter and John and, you know, James or whatever, you know, people have been persecuted for their faith. And so we kind of have that as a baseline. So definitely you don't have to agree with that. But there are lots of places in the Bible where people have disobeyed what seem to be kind of gray area commands from the government. And Christians seem to be like, they wouldn't have done the same, would not have done that. So for instance, I bring this up in 1 Samuel 13. I didn't bring this up in the article, but I just my philosophy about Christians in response to government authority. The Israelites were occupied by the Philistines at the time, and they made a law that said that no one could own any weapons, and the practice of blacksmithing in the nation of Israel had been outlawed. And so if you needed to sharpen your plowshare or your tools or implements, you had to come down to the local Philistine office and pay a tax in order to have your stuff sharpened, because they didn't want people making weapons and using them and stuff like that. And then it goes on to say, but Saul and Jonathan had the weapons.
Right.
And they used them and won a victory, whatever. I thought that was fascinating. So I think that, like, as far as this article is concerned, it says, you know, Bitcoin is used for illicit activities. And I think that there are Christians out there who would say, you know, well, if Bitcoin became illegal, then I guess I'd have to give it up because, you know, I'm supposed to obey the civil authority. Well, like, the civil authority has, I mean, I run in a lot of like very libertarian and some anarchist circles. I wouldn't consider myself an anarchist, a minarchist, but let's just put that aside for a second. The legitimate, like a law that is not based in God's law is not a valid law. So if the government said, everyone's got to stop using Bitcoin, it is now illegal, we'll put you in jail for it, I even as a Christian, like, not as an anarchist, not as a whatever, I'm not going to obey that. Like, they're not going to take it away from me. They're not going to get it. I'm not going to give it up. And similarly, if they said the same thing about guns, I would not give up my guns. I would hide my guns. I would destroy my guns first. I would let them, you know, bottom of the lake, you know, in a boating accident, all those types of things. But there are things that the government has no right to tell you to do. And as a Christian, you do not have to follow those laws when they are, when they're clearly against the Bible. But the economist Greg Phelan, in this article, what his main point on the illegality or the sketchiness of Bitcoin was, people are using it to do a bunch of bad things. And that was kind of his main point.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so funny. We hear that same FUD over and over again. Like,
yeah,
you hear about it on the news where there's some ransomware attack or something like that. It's, but I mean, we all know that money laundering has been going on for the longest time, with Swiss bank accounts, with cash, with regular bank accounts, with, you know, other types of financial instruments, whether it's real estate or whatever, or you know, propped up businesses or, you know, shell companies or something like that. So there has been money laundering going on for ages. And nobody said boo about it until Bitcoin, for some reason. It's like this illegal, illicit money that's now the flourishing of money laundering. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, this is the classic, like, normie FUD, like, oh, Bitcoin is bad because it allows bad things to happen. And it's like, well, look at the normal fiat money right now. Like, are you blind? Like,
yeah.
I'm trying to remember where it was. And it's like when the cartels have their own special window at the banks.
Yeah, right.
Right. And it's like, and it's not just like, it's not just these like one-off bad guys or whatever. It's all wrapped up in government and corporations and stuff too. As if, you know, when they say these things, it's as if the governments are, not involved in these right. things. And like, how many times has the government dropped a, you know, case of cash somewhere as a payoff to this or that. And it's just like, and the money printing that enables the endless wars and suffer, you know, prolongs the suffering of things.
Yeah. And well, and you, the funny thing is you start to see, you mentioned like some criminals will have a special window at the local bank or something like that, but it's the banks who have their own special window to the money supply at,
oh yeah, for sure.
The central bank.
Yeah.
Which is like they're creating, they're doing criminal activities, and things that, you know, when you want to talk about the Commonwealth or the, you know, the common weal or, you know, the common good of people, banks are not operating in the best interest of each individual person. And, you know, that is empowered by central banking. It's funny to me how people haven't thought too much about money. They haven't really thought about where money comes from or where money should come from. And if government wasn't a thing, like pretend that government like just didn't exist, like what would we do to have monetary tools to hold value over space and time? Like what would you do? And it's easy to understand what we would do. We would have, and we did have gold and silver. Like that was what we did.
Right.
It was super easy. And it was easier for a long period of time in such a way that governments, the whole thing about governments, it was government money was a simple mathematical calculation, you know, 8 pieces of one person's, currency to another, to one of another. Like it was mathematical formula based on weight. And we, for some reason, regular people and Christians especially, it's almost like money is the realm and the purview of government. And unless the government is the one doing it, putting it out, it's not valid. And like I've come to tell you, money is Bitcoin is money. Bitcoin is a currency, regardless of what Christine Lagarde says, regardless of what Greg Phelan in this article says. Bitcoin is money. And the reason why I know it's money is because I've used it as money, and I am using it as money. I'm using it to store my wealth. I'm using it to pay for things, which I have done. Now, just because everybody doesn't take it doesn't mean it's not money. Most people don't most people don't take gold coins, and that's still money. And a lot of places don't even take cash, and they can only take credit card or the other way around. But yet those things are still money. And so, yeah, there's so much misunderstanding. It's sad. I'm very sad.
Yeah, and I think that there's just no. It seems to be from most people in the church. There's just no thought to it of like, yeah, like you said, like how do we get our money and where does it come from if it doesn't come from the government? They just kind of at face value accept. Even people who will get passionate about politics and this and that on other subjects, they've clearly, you get to talking to them and it's like they haven't put any thought into this idea of money. And so, you know, either they're just not interested or they just kind of take the normal viewpoint.
So let me get a little theological on you with this point.
And, yeah, please do.
And I believe this comes out of a wrong view of a couple of different issues in the Bible. One is eschatology. So a lot of Christians believe that like we're about to be raptured out of this world and Christ is coming back like any second. And so therefore, what's the point of building up any kind of wealth, storing up any kind of value for the future? Because, you know, the Bible says its end is to be burned. Like there's going to be a time and a place where Christ comes back and he's going to judge the world. And therefore, like it's futile and it's, you know, not long-term thinking. It's high time preference thinking to be thinking about money as a construct and don't worry about it. Just kind of like do the Bible thing, do the gospel thing, do the religious thing, and don't worry about like some of these other issues. I think that's completely false and futile thinking for a couple different reasons. One, the eschatological route, which I believe that every single molecule of this universe belongs to God. It belongs to Jesus. So there's nothing under which like does not fall under God's jurisdiction. And so if it does, that means we're supposed to be using the best money. We're supposed to be using making the best use of resources and things like that. And also I mean, since I'm a post-millennialist, which is a philosophy or a theology that believes that the world is getting more and more better, like in a lot of physical actual ways until Christ returns. But just beside the eschatological aspect of it, there is a spiritual aspect, which Christians forget about the dominion mandate in many ways. And the dominion mandate says, be fruitful, multiply, subdue the earth, take dominion over it, and fill the earth. And so, and you see the opposite of the dominion mandate is what a lot of leftists and liberals do really. So instead of having a view of society and of the future that is being built for your children and for your children's children, it's a view of society and the world that is do everything for myself now. Let's eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Like there's no stewardship. There's no long term thinking, and it's like, I don't want to build cathedrals that last a million years. You know, it's high time preference, short term thinking, and the money is just another tool of dominion, like the internal combustion engine, like electricity, like the telegraph, like the internet. All these things are tools to help us improve our lives, subdue the earth, to make the world a better place for us and our children, our grandchildren, and make and reverse the curse of sin such that we're living in a place that is glorifying to God, that is equitable and just for people to live in. And like, that's the goal of humanity, like while we're here on this earth. That's part of the Christian's job. So for us to say, money doesn't matter. Money is, I've heard Christians say money is the root of all evil. Mm-hmm. That's not the quote. It's the love.
No, it's not. Money.
And so we
is the root of all kinds of evil.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
It's not even like all evil. It's just like all kinds of evil. Yeah, right.
Money
is the spirit of like
it's basically more money, more problems. I mean, kind of,
right?
You know, that's kind of the modern translation of that verse. You're right. It's not. So you hear money is the root of all evil, which is not true. The love of money is the root of all evil, but like the love of money isn't the root of like sexual sin necessarily. It's the root of all kinds of evil. So it meaning that there's a lot of different things. And Jesus talks about money and hell, like biggest topics that Jesus talks about. So money is something that's really on God's mind, and Christians need to wrap their head around the fact that money is an important thing to God. It is a tool of dominion, such that we are able to carry out his will and build his kingdom in the world. And so for us to ignore it or to downplay it or belittle it or think that, you know, render unto Caesar, like it's Caesar's money. So whatever he says is the way things go. That's a short-sighted, and I feel like someone who is lacking faith and understanding as to what role you should be playing in the world as a Christian.
Well, I think that's a misunderstanding of that passage anyway. Have you read, is it Jeff Deist? I'm looking it up real quick. There's a whole, it's on Mises Institute. I'll put a link in the show notes. I'm sorry. It's Jeff Barr. Goes into this explanation of basically like pulling apart this passage where Pharisees try and, you know, they're always trying to trap Jesus and ask him these trick questions, right? And they're asking him if it's right to pay taxes to Caesar, right? And they're trying to trap him in this idea of like, well, if he says it's wrong to pay taxes to Caesar, then he's saying that he's against Caesar and they can turn him over to the Romans. If he says it's right to pay taxes to Caesar, then he's, you know, preaching that it's, you know, he's on the side of the occupying empire mm-hmm. and against the Jews. Right. And so that it's not a genuine question. And that's like, we recognize that as Christians, we talk about it and we recognize it in so many other places where the Pharisees try and trap Jesus and he gives them, you know, he turns around and asks them a question back that proves that they're not being genuine. But it's like, we totally miss it in the way that we teach this passage. And it's like, yep, you should render under Caesar. You should give God your time and your talents, and you should give the government your money. And that's how it gets taught. And it's like, you've totally missed it. There's this whole thing where like he asks them for the coin and ask whose face is on it. And if you go and look historically at that coin, it's like, it's a coin which has Caesar's face on it, which is, you know, in the Jewish tradition, that's a graven image, right? That they shouldn't be carrying around, you know, basically this is an idol that they're carrying around to Caesar, on which is the inscription, the Prince of Peace. So you have, you know, they have the literal Prince of Peace before them, and they're carrying around this idol of someone claiming to be God and claiming to be the Prince of Peace. And there's this whole interplay there in the words that he says, where he's showing them that they're hypocrites. Right. But we just miss all of that. And we just say like, oh, yep, you should give the government your money. Jesus said so.
Yeah. And the funny thing is that when they had the census tax or one of the taxes, Jesus told Peter to go fish for the, you know, put your line in and pull out a fish. And then you'll see a coin in the fish's mouth and use that to pay the tax. So Jesus, as a human, you know, would technically have been subject to the laws of the land, right? I mean, that's what's commonly taught, where Jesus, you know, was, you know, he obeyed the rules, he didn't break the law and all that stuff, but Jesus didn't actually pay taxes out of his own labor. I mean, obviously creating the world by the word of his power is his labor. You know, in 6 days, God created the heavens and the earth, but somehow people miss the fact that Jesus didn't actually work and do anything in order to pay this tax. He just kind of like miracled it into existence. And I think that's a funny kind of, irony when people are putting that together with the, you know, Jesus says pay taxes. And the wonderful next part of it is that where it says, you know, render under Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Well, then I go back and I say to people, well, Bitcoin is not Caesar's. And
exactly.
And the things that Caesar says that are Caesar's are not necessarily Caesar's, because Caesar thinks that, that your healthcare belongs to him, that your children belong to him, that your rights come from him. All those things are false, that your guns belong to Caesar. Which is why I'm against the draft, for instance, because your labor does not belong
to your sons and daughters don't belong to Caesar. Your
sons and daughters do not belong to Caesar. So, Christians, they get caught up in my opinion, Caesarism. Even from the a lot of the founding documents and the founding fathers of the United States in this country, they tended to be very Caesar focused. Like a lot of even in the papers, the Federalist Papers, the Anti-Federalist Papers, they were using like Roman names, you know, like Cato and Cicero was another one, maybe, I think, whatever. But you know what I'm talking about. Like it was very Rome focused. And we as Christians need to be aware and alert about those things. The government should not control money, and they don't control Bitcoin. And if they don't control Bitcoin, that means it's a good, in my opinion, it's a very good thing. It's back to the people. And it's something that Caesar can't take away like they did with the gold in 1933 and 1971.
Right. Well, so talking about like render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and he says, and render unto the Lord's what is the Lord's. And like I said, like a lot of times that's in modern America taught as like, oh, give the taxes to the government, and then give God your time and your talent and your emotion and devotion and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, if you look at the times, you know, the phrase that they would have repeated at the time was, you know, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. Right. So like nothing belongs to Caesar. You could make that argument in turn as like, well, nothing belongs to Caesar. It all belongs to God.
Yeah.
Typically, you know, as is typical, right, Jesus doesn't give them a direct answer because he's not going to fall into their trap. So I'm not saying it is your biblical mandate to avoid paying taxes. I'm not saying that necessarily, like, you know, but I'm just saying you could make that argument that he's saying nothing belongs to Caesar.
Yeah, probably most, a lot of people who are listening to this podcast, if you're a Bitcoiner, you tend to fall into a more libertarian category. At least that's been my experience, not everybody. But typically, I would find that to be the case. a lot of people are anarchists, and they believe that all taxation is theft. And I would probably agree with that like 99.99%. Like just a plain reading of the Bible, in my opinion, would make allowance for the validity of taxation when it comes to the avenger of evil. So
right.
Literally the person who is going to like track down somebody who murdered somebody else or stole something from somebody else. And even then you could crowdsource those, or you could voluntarily give funds to those things and pay for some of those out of the proceeds of fines or whatever. But for the most part, taxes are not God's way. They really are not. And Christians just have bought hook, line, and sinker the, we just should give everything to Caesar because, you know, because he has his name on it. Or, you know, Benjamin Franklin wasn't even a president.
Yeah. So let's talk for a second about let's say we've agreed that, you know, Bitcoin isn't all bad or whatever, and that the normie perspective is off, right? What are ways that, as you know, if you're a Christian and a Bitcoiner, what are ways that we can use Bitcoin for good?
I think of Bitcoin as kind of being a good steward of your money, because if you know anything about the history of the US dollar and other fiat currencies, like if you take an honest, objective look at fiat currency, you know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that they're going to be inflated away into infinity. Like that is the history of fiat currency. That's the history of all money in the history of the world. And that is what's going to happen. So with that as your rubric, like just being a good steward in that sense is put your money in a place where it can't be corrupted as easily. So we have a responsibility as Christians to figure out, like, is this Bitcoin thing really legit? Like, is this a Ponzi scheme? Are we really, you know, doing the best thing that we could be doing with our money right now? I would say that, but right now, yes, because we're about to see massive inflation. We're about to see governments fail. And therefore, this is the place where you hold your money. You know, suppose 100 years from now, or 50, 20 years from now, whatever the time period is, 10 years, I don't know, we have hyper-Bitcoinization. Well, then, like, keeping all your wealth in Bitcoin would be a bad idea, because there's no more monetary, there's no speculative premium between the current value now and, like, just the fact that everybody uses it. I see Bitcoin right now in biblical terms of, like, this is kind of like the pearl of great price. Or, you know, there's a parable in the Bible that talks about a man was digging in a field. He found buried treasure. He kind of looked around and said, I guess nobody saw this. He buried it up. He went and sold everything that he had, bought the field, and then the treasure was his. Someone might argue from an ethical perspective, well, maybe he should have told the person that whose field he was digging in. But the point of the story is he sold out because he saw what was the most valuable thing right now. And for those of us who have kind of like been evangelized and seen the light of Bitcoin and are understanding what's going on in the world, things are collapsing, things are falling apart. Bitcoin is a legitimate way to store your wealth in the future and could possibly overtake and usurp government control of money. Christians need to start thinking, like, I can't be left out of this. Like, here's the ark, you know, get on the ark before it starts raining, because the flood is coming. You know, we've heard that type of thing before. Gold bugs in the 80s, 70s, 80s, 90s were hot and heavy on gold. And I know a lot of Christians who are really super involved in gold. And I was involved in that gold and silver for a long time. But so as a Christian, I think as Christians, we need to figure out, is this legit? Is this the best use of my money at this time? And if it is, then you need to go into it like in a heavy way, a responsible way, so that you are prepared. That's from like an investment perspective. That's how I see that.
Yeah. And so for me, I think, you know, cause I see people argue on Twitter all the time, like, oh, you know, it should be used, it should be spent. And then the people are like, no, hodling's perfectly legitimate. And I'm kind of like, it depends on what your circumstances are. I think for a lot of people in, you know, America and some other Western countries where, like, yeah, they're inflating away the purchasing power of the dollar, but it's not like, you know, Zimbabwe or somewhere like that yet. And so, like, for us, in a lot of ways, like, hodling probably is the most productive use of the hedge against inflation. But in a lot of places, in some places, like the censorship resistant transaction might be a more productive use. And I think there's a real potential there for use of Bitcoin to fund missions, in places that are close to the gospel, or even just, you mentioned in your article, the difficulty of, you know, wiring, like doing a money transfer.
Right.
So kind of, for those who hadn't read the article, explain like kind of your I guess experience with using the money transfer.
Well, it's funny after the same meeting in which somebody asked me about the article, who was a pastor in my presbytery. We were talking about giving money to a missionary overseas in Africa, and somebody was about to send a transfer over, and they were saying, "Well, let's call everybody else up and see if they want to give money too, because we don't want to do multiple wire transfers, because it's like $60 to send a wire transfer."
Wow.
It's like, first off, in my experience, like, I've only used wire transfers a handful of times in my life, and one was more recently. And when I did it, it took me 5 days to get my money from my bank settled into the new place where I could actually use it at that point. And it's expensive. And so, like, if you're a Christian,
and it doesn't even make sense why, because they're basically just updating their database. with the other person's database.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and it's kind of like a, they're doing a secret like handshake that, okay, you're not going to renege on this deal here. Like this is for real. Right. That's kind of the way it is. And that's basically just six confirmations where we're coming from. But right. A Christian is able to stream money, via the Lightning Network to a missionary around the world without censorship, without a lag time, and without the fear of it being confiscated in any way, shape, or form. So, like, if I wanted to support a missionary in Iran, that'd probably be a very difficult thing for me to do. I probably would have to give money to an international agency that had fraternal ties with Iran and be able to do it that way. It'd probably take a long time. There'd be overhead and expense and stuff like that. Meanwhile, I could send 100 sats an hour to somebody in Iran, and nobody can stop me from doing that. Like, if you don't see, maybe most Christians, like, they're like, whoa, that's, a really cool party trick. That's really not great. Yeah. What's the compelling reason? Like, for a lot of people, the remittance thing is a huge thing.
Yes.
For most of us in the West, it is not a huge thing. In many countries, it is life or death. And they're the ones going to Western Union every week to send money back to home. So, it has great implications for not being able to be seized and confiscated, either in transit or at the destination. So Christians really need to be, kind of at the forefront of that. And I feel like there used to be a lot of missions conferences and people talking about, Christians that were doing things underground and smuggling Bibles and stuff like that. And that type of thing is not, like the cypherpunk ethos that used to be involved with Christianity, is not there anymore. It's really not.
No, it's not that I like welcome authoritarianism, but I feel like, I don't know. We talk about the world going in this cycle of good times create weak men, and weak men create bad times, and bad times create strong men, and strong men create good times. And we see that cycle. But I think you see that within the church too, of pressure from the world and trying to stamp out the gospel is what lights this fire for. Yeah. For spreading the gospel. And you see it throughout the Bible and you see it throughout history but it's kind of this, like, you look at America and I'm not saying there aren't good things being done in this country, but the fact that people want to cry about religious persecution here in America. And there are some places, I'm not going to pretend there's no religious persecution in America, but by and large,
it's not.
People's lives are not on the line. Their livelihood might be a little bit, but you still have the freedom to move to a different city. And that's not easy. I'm not saying that that's nothing, but you're not getting drug off to the gulag here in America for it. But in some places they are, right? And so there is something to when the hammer comes down and they start pressing against it is when it makes people's faith real.
Yeah, we've lived cushy lives in America, and we have very little. We have a very little memory about history, and the history that we do have, I feel like, is very. It's actually very kind of like Nazi Germany centric, which is fascinating to me. And I feel like it shouldn't. I mean, like, obviously, lots of bad stuff happened, during that time. But it's almost as if, like, in my mind, like, when I think of Germans, I think of Christian theologians, and so I feel like,
right,
the Martin Luther and John Calvin, and I mean, John Calvin was from France and Switzerland, but but like that area of the world, for many Christians, whether they're Catholic or Protestant, tends to be like, that was a dark time in our history of life and of the West, but like, we really need to go to, you mentioned the gulags, to the history of the Soviet Union. And I've been listening to the Gulag Archipelago. I've been posting some quotes from that. And it is horrific. It is like, in my opinion, it's like, people always use like Hitler and like the Holocaust as, you know, the most crazy amount of evil.
Right.
As I go further down the Soviet Union rabbit hole, I see just unimaginable brutality and thoughtlessness for, and not even for like a racist, you know, Germans against the Jews, but against your own people, against like your own brothers.
Right.
And that was like even more crazy. So
everybody knows about like Kristallnacht and Auschwitz, but nobody talks about Holodomor
or like the archipelago that was just like spread across the Soviet Union that were like, the one with the gold, just the K. I'll think of it as soon as we're done here, but like these where they're mining for gold and stuff like that and sending people the Solovetsky Islands and just the and so with like with German with like the German oppression and the Nazi oppression of the Jews, it was like you had a bunch of Christians who were oppressing a bunch of Jewish people, which was obviously bad. But in Russia, you had a bunch of, you saw like what happens when there's like no God and like godless, you know, talk about like godless communism and stuff like that. Like it's even more brutal. And so as Christians, like we don't really know a lot of that history. And we think like, you know, it can't happen here. We live in a time of peace and we've gotten over World War II, and everything that's happened since World War II has just kind of been like the sputtering out of evil, you know, whether it was Vietnam or whatever, but like, we are not that far away from people and people that are still living who it was like horrific. In quote unquote Christian places too. So, when you bring that type of thing up to people, they scoff, they laugh, and they kind of like, well, you know, you're just doomsday person or whatever, or you're, you know, conspiracy theorist, pessimist, whatever kind of label that you want to put out there. But it's really important. It's important for us to know our history and for us to like, Proverbs says, a wise man perceives the danger and hides himself. And I'm perceiving danger. I really do, as a Christian, as an American, as just a human on this earth. And so we need to be, as the Bible says, wise as serpents, harmless as doves, and do everything that we can to be ready to protect our families and our loved ones, and to continue a civilization that's glorifying God.
Yeah, and you and I had kind of chatted back and forth, and I was telling you, because I had read the Eric Metaxas has a really good biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Mm-hmm. And you know, everybody wants to act like, when they learn about Nazi Germany, everyone wants to act like, oh, I would never do that.
Right.
You know, but like, if you reading through that and some other stuff, and you realize how the Gestapo embedded itself in the church and not necessarily took over the church for a long time, but that book does a really good job of talking through kind of the battles that were going on in the church in Germany, and how Lutheranism, which is basically all of Christendom in Germany at the time, was co-opted by the Nazis, and it was subtle and it was sneaky and it was not obvious at first. And they used, you know, Luther, did great things, but he also at the end of his life said some really crazy things, and they took the crazy things out of context, and or maybe crazy is not the right word, but you know, things that were said offhanded or whatever, and they took them out of context and used it to manipulate the people in the church. And so reading through how that happened and how things continued to get worse, and people would turn over their neighbors or report on them, and it's very eye-opening, and the modern church needs to be aware of how those things happen. Like you said, like learn from the history and perceive the danger.
But I think the moral of the story, or kind of like how I'm taking all this, is Bitcoin, if it's flourishing and if it does what we think it's going to do, is going to remove the power and ability of governments to do a lot of bad, evil, crazy things, just by virtue of them not having the power to print money and borrow money, at will. That keeps them in check. That keeps them honest, so to speak. And I think that's when we talk about Bitcoin being honest money or being good money, it's because we have the rules of the game. There's no forgery. There's no faking. There's no sliding a little bit, slicing off a little bit for myself on the side here, you know, government bureaucrats or you know, other regimes who are doing bad things. It is honest money. And if you want money, you got to come by it honestly, which is tax the people, and you're going to be held accountable for it. I think that's when we move to a society that's more free of government control, that's when we're going to flourish. It's becoming so obvious to me that the more government there is, the worse humans are. It's funny, people don't believe that. They think that, like, we just haven't had the right government, we haven't had the right regime, or, you know, they're getting bought off by the evil capitalists or whatever. We need less government, we need more freedom, and watch the people flourish.
Yeah, well said. All right, Huddleberry, where can people find you or you know, hear more about what you have to say?
I'm not really selling anything or doing anything right now. So,
no SoundCloud.
Not right now. So you can just, my SoundCloud, Huddleberry at Twitter, and you know, I'm around. Say hi.
Very cool, man. Well, thanks for your time.
Thank you, buddy. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Later. All right, guys, that is going to be the show for today. You guys go follow Huddleberry on Twitter. Check out the article that he posted on Bitcoin Magazine. Go back and read the original article on the Gospel Coalition as well. It's just know that it is like a really bad take, a very normie take, but you know, that'll give you some context, and then read Huddleberry's article. And then, like I said, follow him on Twitter. Great guy. I wish that I could tell you that I'm going to start having consistent episodes every week or every other week. I can't tell you that. What I will tell you is that I'm going into my last semester of school. And so hopefully, you know, here in about 6-8 months, once I'm done with school, have a new job with hopefully more consistent hours and not being in school all the time, I can get back to making content more regularly. I don't think I'm ever going to be that guy who just puts out a show every week just to put out a show every week. I don't have sponsors on this show, and I kind of like having that freedom. And I like having the freedom if I don't think there's anything new or interesting. I don't feel like Bitcoin really ever has this point where there's not something interesting going on, but if it's been covered on 3 other podcasts, I'm not going to cover it. Like, that's redundant. Hopefully should have some more content out this semester. I am going to try and put out a few more episodes. But anyways, you know, as far as this episode, let me know what you guys think. Had an interview previously with Bitcoin Rabbi, and so I think the great thing, not to go into a whole big discussion on various faiths and all that, that's not really what this show is about. I'm happy to have that conversation with you, DM me or whatever, like, let's have that conversation, and I'll tell you why the Christian faith is the best, is the true faith, but that's not really what this show is about. I just, you know, Bitcoin is honest money, right? It's money for friends, it's money for enemies. And so it is compatible with basically all faiths as far as I'm aware. If you accept Bitcoin or have a system for accepting Bitcoin at your church or nonprofit organization or something like that, and you think you have a good system down, let me know, because this is something I've thought about before. You know, we talked about it in this episode, and it's something that I have thought through, specifically for an organization that is not Bitcoin related, where you don't want accepting Bitcoin to become the focus of that organization, and how you did that, and is it something where they hold on to the Bitcoin? Is it something where they immediately turn around and sell it? And if so, like, how much of a point is there in that? Anyway, these are the things that we discussed. If you have thoughts or experience with any of these things, let me know. I would appreciate it. That's going to kind of do it. You guys know how to keep up with me on Twitter at BottomShelfBTC. You may have missed somewhere in the interim when I wasn't producing new episodes. I somehow let my domain name registration was not set up for auto renewal somehow, and it got swiped, and I am not paying thousands of dollars to get back bottomshelfbitcoin.com. So I am no longer there. If you don't want to use a podcast app to find the show, just go to bottomshelfbtc.com. So at least the domain name now matches my Twitter handle. So there's that. All right. For Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, I'm Josh Humphrey. Thanks for listening.